This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The first chapter of Frank DeFord's new memoir is entitled A Not Very Bright Boy. A little self-deprecating, perhaps, for the guy GQ magazine is called the world's greatest sports writer. Anyway, DeFord went to Princeton in the early 60s, but was only a so-so student. But Princeton did give him access to what he calls that celebrated old boy network and landed him a job at Time, Inc., at a relatively new magazine called Sports Illustrated. And so begins a remarkable sports writing career.
Frank DeFord, of course, is well known to NPR listeners for his weekly commentaries on Morning Edition, which are often funny and always full of strong opinion and insight. He's written eloquently about sports for 50 years, and his stories aren't so much about the games as they are about the rich cast of characters who play them, coach them, and love them.
And it seems as though he's written about almost all of them, from Ted Williams and Bobby Orr to Muhammad Ali and Billie Jean King, from Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson to Don Budge and Arthur Ashe, to name just a few. He's the author of 18 books. His new memoir is called Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer. And Frank DeFord is with us now. And Frank, welcome. It's so good to have you.
Anthony, the nicest thing you said in all of that was that I was a so-so student.
Well, let's start, because that's where you start the book. It's such an amusing anecdote where you get to Time, Inc. With your Princeton diploma, and you're sort of followed around by this folder that identifies you how?
You open it up, and there were my clippings, but it had sort of a summary of me, and a so-so student, it said, not very bright. That was the first words that anybody interviewing me were going to read. It did say, but, you know, maybe can put a sentence together. But everybody who looks at me, not very bright. Well, it irritated me. It got my dander up. I was a cocky kid anyway. And so I just started telling people I wasn't interested in them anyway.
You weren't interested in them anyway, and that sort of provided your route to Sports Illustrated,
right?
That's right,
because Sports Illustrated heard that this kid was putting down Time, putting down Life, which were then the elite magazines of the world. And that made me much more attractive to Sports Illustrated. Now, I wasn't smart enough to figure this out, Anthony. I'm not that clever. But by lunchtime, I was in the executive dining room eating with editors. And really, by the time I left the building that afternoon, I essentially had a job offer.
But did you go in there? You went in there wanting to write for Sports Illustrated.
Yes, I wanted to write for Sports Illustrated. Yeah. Though I always am quick to make the to clarify that it wasn't so much because it was a sports magazine, but it was a very well-written magazine.
Yeah.
I didn't want to write for Time. I didn't want to write for Life anyhow. So it wasn't as if I was giving anything up by you know, telling these people to shove it.
Listeners, we're talking with veteran sports writer Frank DeFord about his long and fascinating career. He's seen the industry change. He's written just about everyone in the world of sports. And if you have questions or want to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also follow us at Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. Frank, you write that when you started, sports writing was still in something of a netherworld. You write, I got in just before the sun came up. I want you to sort of elaborate on that a little bit.
There were a lot of, for lack of a better word, crooks still in sports writing. Mm. The local sports editor was often on the take. You wanted to get an article in the newspaper, you had to grease his palm. And beyond that, I don't mean to suggest that the whole thing was a mafia environment. There were a lot of hacks.
Yeah.
Sports writing attracted hacks. It attracted people who didn't really know how to write, who were, in effect, sports fans who had wanted to get into sports one way or another, and so they came in as writers and they really couldn't write. Now, that's not to say there hadn't been through the years some magnificent writers. There were. But we were still looked down upon. There was no question about that. And today, we're a much more honorable profession than we were when I got into it.
You write, speaking of the guys that could write, wonderfully well describing that old generation of sports writers and what they were like, people like Red Smith. I wanted to ask you about Jimmy Cannon, who I don't know a lot about, but I read with interest in your memoir about him, star columnist for the Hearst chain, and you write the only columnist you could mention in the same breath as Red Smith.
Cannon was an entirely different writer than Smith. He was a much punchier writer, as you might expect somebody from Hearst, but he was good.
Hmm.
He was often compared to Damon Runyon, But that was more because of the characters he wrote about. He was himself much more of a Hemingway fan. He wrote the famous line, and this is typical of Jimmy Cannon. He was writing about Joe Louis, and he said, "A tribute to his race, the human race."
Ah.
There was a certain melodrama,
sure,
to what Jimmy wrote. And he also had some fabulous sense of humor, and he wrote a column called "Nobody Asked Me But." He wrote that about once or twice a week, and it would be the most eclectic collection of observations that he had. He had a great eye.
I got a couple of examples.
Go
from
ahead,
your book.
Please.
"Nobody asked me, but I can't remember staying for the end of a movie where the actors wore togas."
Exactly. Yeah.
I love that. "Nobody asked me, but guys who use other people's coffee saucers for ashtrays should be banned from public places."
That's right. Yeah, like that. "Nobody asked me, but when is it you can't help but fall for a woman with a gardenia in her hair?" I mean, he would say things like that.
And
Jimmy was a very odd duck, though, very much a loner. He never got married, lived alone in a hotel all his life. His column was pretty much everything, meant everything to him. But there were writers like Cannon who were original. And this goes all the way back to Ring Lardner around the turn of the century. Often in those days, like Ring Lardner, the best sports writers left the profession.
Mm-hmm.
You could only go so far. Paul Gallico was another one. But it also threw up some really, really fine writers. I think Red Smith is as good a columnist as we've ever had. I'm not talking about sports columns. Mm-hmm. He developed the art of the column better than anyone who's ever worked for a newspaper.
There was a great what struck me so much about what you wrote about Jimmy Cannon is you wrote that statistics were coming into vogue then, reporting on statistics, and you wrote that when Cannon sees a guy named Leonard Shapiro of the New York Press come into the press booth with a briefcase, he snaps at him, "What do you got in there, Leonard? Decimal points?" And you write that looking back, that was absolutely prescient for what had happened to the craft. And by that you mean a focus on statistics as opposed to the craft of writing?
Yeah, and it's with dismay that this has only gotten worse. Now, part of the reason this has gotten worse is that writers do not have the access to athletes that they had once upon a time. So if you can't meet somebody personally, you tend to fall back on those kind of bland, bald, but very obvious numbers. And I think we're just knee-deep sometimes in statistics when you read an article about someone. And that's always the jeopardy of sports writing, that we're in love with statistics. It's sort of funny, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, I'm very drawn to the kind of writing that you've done over the years where it seems, and we mentioned this in the intro, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you use sports to tell stories about people as opposed to telling stories about sports first and foremost.
When I first came to the magazine, I covered basketball. This is in my 20s, tennis, baseball. And when I was about 30, I remember going to the managing editor, a fascinating man, Andre Laguerre. He had been de Gaulle's press secretary during the war. And I said, "Andre, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to write, if I'm going to stay here, I've got to write longer pieces about people. I don't want to cover sports anymore." And happily, he said, "I was sort of expecting you to say that." And so that was sort of, in many ways, that was the end of my career as a traditional sports writer. I've covered a few events through the years, but I've never been the kind of sports writer that most people envision sports writers are like.
You were never drawn to the beat.
Never wanted to be in the beat. Don't like locker rooms. Sports writers, you know, we assemble in press boxes. We move en masse. And I was always the guy out by himself in the middle of nowhere, you know, working, you know, the lone wolf, Tex, riding the range out there by myself. But I loved it. I mean,
yeah.
that's what I wanted to do, and that's the existence that I carved out for myself.
Well, there are a bunch of stories I want to ask you about, including some characters from the Boston sports world. Listeners, we're talking to Frank DeFord. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. And Frank, speaking of Boston figures, you were the first person to write about a hockey player of some repute named Bobby Orr.
That's really funny. I mean, talking about things that I fell into, I didn't know a hockey puck from a quoit or a badminton bird. But because the Celtics won every year, I spent an awful lot of time with the Boston writers, so-called Knights of the Keyboard, as Ted Williams had christened them. And so in being with the Knights of the Keyboard late at night after a playoff game in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Philadelphia, wherever, the writers would all talk about the Bruins, who were then in last place. Hmm. And they were in last place every year. There were only six teams in the league, and the Bruins were sixth every year. But in Canada, they practically weaned hockey players away from their mother's breast and would send them off to something called Junior A at age before their voices changed. And the players were drafted, and the Bruins, because they were so awful, had gotten, in effect, a pick of the litter, and it was this kid named Bobby Orr. I think he was owned by them from the age of 14 on. Hmm. And I kept hearing about Bobby Orr. 3 more years, Bobby Orr will be here. 2 more years. I mean, you know, it's like this. So I go back to Sports Illustrated and tell them, I said, the next great hockey player is a kid named Bobby Orr from Parry Sound, Ontario, as if I really knew. And so I went up when it was finally time, when his 18th birthday came, I went up to Parry Sound. And the greatest coincidence of all, I went up with a guy named Leo Monahan from the Record American. He was going to do the local story. I was going to do the national story. Yeah. And we were having breakfast that morning, and I asked the waitress. I said, do you know the way to the Orr's house? And she said, yes. And that was Bobby Orr's mother, the waitress.
That's fantastic.
So she knew how to get there.
Yeah.
And I did the story on the first story on Bobby, and that made me look like a genius because, of course, he turned out to be very quickly the greatest defenseman in the history of hockey.
And you said a moment ago that you didn't know a lot about hockey. Was it clear as day when you saw him skate
No.
and play and hit a puck that he knew what he was doing?
No, stop it. I wouldn't have known. You could have fooled me. A donkey could come out and skate it, and I wouldn't have known. Yeah. I had no idea. I'd seen a few hockey games, but to propose Yeah. that Frank DeFord was any kind of hockey expert would be absolutely ridiculous. Matter of fact, I've never been very good at divining. Even in the sports that I know pretty well, I'd make a terrible scout.
Well, you had a great quote, though, from Bobby Orr in there. I don't think he said, you quote him, I don't think most people can understand what little pressure I felt out there. It was like I was skating in a balloon, only you can't take that balloon anywhere else with you.
He told me that like 20 years later, and yeah. it's the best definition of what it's like to be a natural.
Yeah.
And to be the best that you are. It probably applies when you think about it to art or literature or music or anything, but it's all the more so in sport because in sport you have such a shelf life.
Yeah.
So he was in this balloon, and there was no pressure on him, and we all thought there must be. But he was just so good. It just came so terribly, terribly naturally.
Yeah.
And
but of course, he can't stay in that balloon forever, and that's where the challenge comes.
Bobby's knees went.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to look at him now. I mean, I don't think he was much more than 5'8 or 5'9. And whole generations have gone by. You know, players are just so much bigger now than they ever were.
Frank DeFord, we've got some callers that want to get in on this conversation. 800-423-8255 to make the connection here with Frank DeFord. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Plymouth. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to say hello to Mr. DeFord and tickle his memory a little bit. He was talking about access and also Boston athletes. But I heard a story one time, I think it was on NPR, where he was in a car for an extended period with Bill Russell. And I wanted to see if we could get him to talk about that.
Yeah, Bill, and this, I know exactly when this was. It was 1999. And maybe because the century was coming to a close, friends of Russell had told him, you know, Bill, people are forgetting you. They don't really remember you anymore. And he had sort of, you know, disappeared. Bill never courted publicity. And he sort of made a comeback, a visibility comeback. And I was asked to write an article about him for Sports Illustrated, which I was anxious to do. And Bill was living then in Seattle, as he is now, and his very elderly father was at a home in Oakland. And Bill and I just drove down to see his father. It was really a story about fathers and sons, I suppose, even though the son was in his 60s then. And we drove down all the way from Seattle to Oakland. Bill drove all the way. I remember that. We were going to split the driving, but he didn't want to give up the wheel. I think that's the way he played basketball. And I had known Bill through the years, so it wasn't like we were discovering each other. But we just had a remarkably candid and fun conversation for 12, 13, 14 hours with whatever it was.
Well, he's finally getting a sculpture in his honor in Boston, as you probably heard and know about, and I guess you might be among the people who say it's overdue.
Well, it is. I remember how furious Tommy Heinsohn was when they named the tunnel after Ted Williams. And Tommy,
what did he say?
Tommy said something to the effect like, well, he never won a championship and they gave him a tunnel. I mean, what are they going to do, name the whole Mass Pike after Bill Russell? He said it a little more colorfully than
but he was
correct. I mean, I do believe that Bill is the greatest team player in any sport, certainly that I've ever seen in all my life. He had the greatest, most positive effect on players around him of anybody that I've ever seen.
Let's go to Anthony, who's calling from Somerville. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Oh, good day. It's a pleasure to speak to you, Mr. DeFord. I'm a big fan of yours for a long time.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, the other morning you mentioned something about ties being almost un-American and sponsoring and saying how great hockey is for having shootouts. And I wanted to ask you, as a fairly competitive sportsman myself, ties sometimes means that I was just not good enough to get the victory. And there's something to be learned from that. Is hockey shootouts not like giving everyone a medal at the end of a kid's soccer game?
Well, no, because half the people don't get medals. So, I mean, I think you play games. Obviously, you play them for a lot of reasons, starting with the simple one of exercise. But particularly in any kind of championship competition, any kind of league, you play games to find out who's better. That's why we keep score. And if it ends in a tie, somehow to me, that's not satisfying. I understand your point. But to me, a tie game is very unfulfilling. I leave a tie game thinking, no, we got to figure out who's better here. Games are not perfect. Games are often the worst team wins. You know, there are lucky breaks and so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, I think somebody ought to win and somebody ought to lose.
Anthony, thanks so much for that call. That commentary you had on the air, just I guess it was just yesterday, about your dislike of ties. Did you hear a lot from? Did you get a lot of response from folks on that one?
Yeah, rather like Anthony. Yeah, no, I'm serious. And you got to remember that most of mankind has grown up loving soccer.
Yeah.
And ties are almost one third of soccer games, which has always confounded me all the more, Anthony. That I'm completely baffled.
I tend to agree with you about soccer, and I find the shootout incredibly unsatisfying.
Yes.
Because it's almost like a different game. They play soccer for an hour and a half. It's a tie, and it's like, okay, well, let's play another game, another sport altogether to figure out who won. There's no passing. There's no teamwork. There's nothing to do with soccer in the shootout.
I completely agree with you there. The only problem is, in a soccer championship, you've got to have a winner.
Yeah, you've got to have a winner.
And so you've got to figure out a way. Now, maybe there's a better way of doing it. I'll leave that up to the soccer
experts. Rock, paper, scissors. I don't know.
But it sure is fun to watch it, isn't it?
It is fun.
It's like a pinball machine. It's great.
Well, there are a couple of other people I'd love to ask you about. Speaking of Boston athletes, you wrote about Ted Williams, who had a pretty rough time with the press in his day. But he managed to sort of turn that reputation around, you write, in his later years. You call him loyal, charming, wonderful company.
Yeah.
Someone who managed to really turn that reputation around in his later years.
Most athletes from an early age sort of get typed. This guy is a good guy. This guy's a funny guy. This guy's disagreeable. This guy is controversial. And the Boston press, the Knights of the Keyboard, really took after Williams almost from the day that he was got here, and it gave him even a national reputation as being sort of a prickly, spoiled guy, uncooperative. And there were parts of Williams that were that way. For example, he would not tip his cap. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that he was beloved by his teammates. He was an exuberant personality. I wouldn't have wanted to be married to him. I think that would have been a very difficult. He was not good maybe on one-on-one situations. Mm-hmm. But altogether, he was a charming guy, and I knew him late in life. And he was just a joy to be around. He was just so full of life.
And I loved what you wrote about his friendship with Bob Feller, perhaps one of the greatest pitchers of all time, facing perhaps the best hitter of all times, and they sort of got on like gangbusters in their old age.
Oh, I can see them now together down in Florida. They were there. They were trying to get Shoeless Joe Jackson, who was one of the guys who fixed the 1919 World Series. Mm. And it was their contention that Jackson ought to at least be considered for the Hall of Fame.
Right.
As Williams said, and I'll leave out the vulgarity here so we can stay on the air.
I appreciate that.
Jackson had been given a lifetime ban, and only baseball could continue to ban someone 50 years after their lifetime was over.
Right.
And the point was, They weren't even saying he should be in the Hall of Fame. They were saying, for goodness sake, give the man a chance. And they addressed a crowd of Sabre. Those are those numbers guys.
Yep.
And I mean, they walked into that room, and Williams had a walker. Feller was much more. Feller lived into his 90s, and he was a much healthier character right up to the end, pitching, batting practice. But the two of them, it was like watching gods come down from Mount Olympus.
Good for Ted Williams, good for Bob Feller for speaking up for Shoeless Joe. And Frank DeFord, good for you for this book, Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer. What a delight. Thank you very, very much.
Anthony, thank you for having me on.
Frank DeFord is a senior contributing editor to Sports Illustrated. He's also a regular commentator at Morning Edition. His new memoir is Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer. You can catch Frank DeFord tonight at Porter Square Books in Cambridge. He'll be there with Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. There's information about that. We also have an excerpt from his memoir at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Hillary Hughes joins us for our weekend picks. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.